Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details. Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit Lowe's.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective, and each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. As you may have noticed, today's episode didn't have a teaser, and that's because I wanted to do something a little different for the final episode of 2024. Instead of following our usual format, I wanted to give you an update on two cases we covered earlier this year: Rachel Hansen, a 19-year-old woman who was murdered in June of 2022, and Madalena Kojikari, an 11-year-old girl who went missing in November of 2022. Now, before diving into these updates, I wanted to take a moment to reflect on what has been my first full year hosting Detective Perspective, and it has had its ups and downs, its peaks and valleys, but overall, I would consider this year a huge success. We kicked out 49 episodes in 2024, plus I sprinkled in a few lives there. I would like to do more in 2025 of those. And I do have some other plans, which you can't see off screen here, but it will be playing a factor in Detective Perspective moving forward. And I think it's going to have a positive impact. This year was incredible for the show. And I really feel like we're starting to gain some momentum. The responses that I'm getting in the comments, also some of the DMs and the emails that I'm receiving as well, I can see from the feedback from not only the people who are connected to the cases that I'm covering, but also from the people who are tuning in to listen or to watch these episodes and see what type of impact they can make just by sharing this information. And I will say, although we didn't have any official closes to any of these cases in 2024, there have been some updates and there was some information relayed to me, and I believe three cases where I passed on that information to agencies involved with that case. And there were also a couple of you who reached out and said, hey, you know, I don't know if this is going to be helpful or not. Do you think I should reach out? And my answer has always been yes. But overall, and I've said it numerous times, starting this channel and using this type of format and covering these types of cases, there wasn't a guarantee that it was going to work. As I've learned over the years in quote unquote entertainment, unsolved cases are not the most popular cases to cover. It's human instinct to want that arc to the story where there's, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you get that resolution, that payoff at the end, which leaves the audience feeling fulfilled. So when you don't have that, there are people who are turned off by it. And I can understand, it's depressing, but the reality is that's the world we live in. Over 50% of the homicides in this country go unsolved. And there are many reasons behind that. But as a society, I don't want to fall into the trap of saying, oh, you know what? That's too depressing to talk about. Let's talk about something more positive where we catch the bad guy. because the families out there who don't have that justice yet, they deserve to have answers to their family's tragedies and to find out who's responsible for what happened to their loved one, or in the missing persons cases, where is their loved one? And there has everything been done that can be done to try and find them as soon as possible. So as I sit here today and I look at what we've been able to accomplish and how the channel has grown, I'm extremely grateful to each and every one of you. And it motivates me to continue to not only move forward, but to enhance the experience, to do even more. And I'm not only talking about what we're actually doing in this true crime ecosystem and some of the other things that I have planned, but finding ways to give back to the people in need even more than we did in 2024. We have had a couple donations that we've made, but there's even more we can do. And I am going to talk about my coffee company, Criminal Coffee Company, at the end of this episode. I won't do it now because I know some of you, probably many of you, already know about Criminal Coffee. And some of you just want to hear the updates in the cases. So I'll save it for the end. I'll be nice. But I do want to say one more thing as far as enhancements with Detective Perspective. Many of you have asked for merchandise, but it wasn't a top priority for me. But I'm happy to report we finally got it done. And the design is pretty cool. So if you go over to officialderek.com and you click on the shop button there, you will find the one and only t-shirt design that we currently have. It's a Detective Perspective t-shirt. It's pretty cool. We have more designs planned. We have a few more planned, actually. But I wanted to get one out to you guys before the end of the year. And if you order relatively soon, you got to order pretty quickly, we might be able to get everybody covered before Christmas. It's going to be close. I'm not going to make any guarantees. If you order the 19th or the 20th, it might be too late. But if you order as soon as you hear or watch this episode, which should be the 16th or the 17th, I feel confident that we should be able to get most of those orders out and in your hands before Christmas. But that's all I really wanted to say. Again, thank you to each and every one of you. It may not seem like a lot, but every single person who's came and listened to an episode or watched an episode or put a comment in the comment section or left a like, it really does help. There's an algorithm that I don't completely understand where if people are engaging with the content you're creating, it's more likely to be seen by more people. More people seeing and hearing these episodes means more exposure for the victims and their families. So it goes hand in hand. You're not only helping me, you're helping the people that I'm talking about. And so that brings us to what we're doing here today. I could have done another episode. It would have been pretty easy to do. We have hundreds, if not thousands of them to cover. But I always say at the end of every episode that if there's an update, I'll be sure to let you know. And if there was a solve, I wouldn't have waited until the end of the year. We don't have a solve, unfortunately. But I felt like there were two cases in particular that deserved to have an update episode. And I wanted to wrap 2024 up with these updates. And because I have two of them, I felt like I could fill out a whole episode. So as I mentioned, it's Rachel Hansen and Madalena Kojikari. These cases have had a lot of movement in them since I've covered them. So instead of just doing a live where not everyone gets to see or hear it, I wanted to do a full episode. So with that out of the way, let's dive into the updates, and we're going to start with Rachel Hansen. In case you need a recap from the original episode, on June 2nd, 2022, 19-year-old Rachel moved back into a gated apartment complex at 1900 South Coronado Road in Gilbert, Arizona. She had lived in the same apartment in 2021 before subleasing it, but in the spring of 2022, she decided to return. Just 2 days later, in the early hours of June 4th, Rachel called 911 at approximately 2 a.m., She reported that someone had entered her apartment and shot her. When first responders arrived, they found Rachel on the bathroom floor. She was rushed to the hospital where surgeons worked for 3 hours to save her life. Tragically, Rachel died later that morning, just 8 days before her 20th birthday. Police immediately launched an investigation into Rachel's death, but the case quickly encountered significant challenges. The apartment complex had no surveillance cameras in the hallways, and neighbors reported hearing nothing unusual, not even the gunshot. Despite exhaustive efforts, police were unable to identify a suspect. In February of 2024, they announced that the case had gone inactive after pursuing all available leads without success. However, since Rachel's episode was released in April, there have been a few updates. At the end of August 2024, the police released transcripts of Rachel's 911 call along with the body cam footage from the responding officers. Now let's start with the 911 transcripts. After dialing 911, Rachel told the dispatcher, quote, "I've been shot. Someone broke in and shot me," before providing her address and apartment number. She pleaded, quote, please hurry, oh blank, I'm bleeding." Now, when I say blank, I'm not doing that because I'm avoiding any type of demonetization by saying the expletive she said. It's actually redacted in the transcript and in the report. And what you will find throughout this episode is a lot of things were redacted. And that is going to be a common theme that we hear throughout the update of Rachel's case and something that her family's not completely happy with. Now, when the dispatcher asked if anyone was in the home, Rachel replied no and confirmed that the shooter had already left. The dispatcher tried to calm her, urging her to stay on the line and apply pressure to the wound with anything nearby, like a clean cloth, a shirt, or a towel. Rachel, however, said there was nothing within reach. The dispatcher continued trying to engage her, saying, quote, "Rachel, I need you to talk to me, okay?" But Rachel's reply was, quote, "I can't." About 4.5 minutes after Rachel's call, firefighters and police arrived, and this is where the body cam footage begins. Now, the footage, which was blurred and redacted in certain places, captures officers conducting a security sweep of the area. Multiple officers can be seen swarming Rachel's apartment building with their guns drawn, but as we already know, the shooter was gone. When police and firefighters finally entered Rachel's apartment, they found her lying on the bathroom floor. And in the body cam footage, you can hear officers shouting at Rachel to stay with them before she was rushed to the hospital. Rachel's parents appeared to be supportive of the decision to release the 911 transcripts and the body cam footage to the public. However, they expressed frustration with the heavy redactions and lack of audio from the 911 call. Rachel's mother, Kim, told the media, quote, "We wanted to hear our daughter's voice and her last words that she spoke, so we are disappointed it was transcript only." And I completely understand where Kim's coming from here, and I actually agree with her. Without hearing the tape myself, if it's exactly what the transcript says, why wouldn't you release the audio to the public as well? Or at minimum, have Rachel's parents come in for a private listening where they can sit with officers and hear the tape for themselves. What harm would that really do? And with everything that they've gone through, couldn't we at least give them that? Now, a few months passed before the next significant update in the case, but in early October, police released a 350-page report on their investigation. Like the earlier materials, the report was heavily redacted, but it still revealed some new information. For example, the report showed that in April of 2022, Rachel had called the police to report that her fiancé's father had threatened her. Now, unfortunately, the details about the alleged threat were not included, but this is something I would definitely want to know more about. When the assistant chief of police was asked if Rachel's fiancé's father had been investigated, he responded, quote, "I can't unfortunately speak to everybody we've talked to. Our detectives tirelessly investigated every lead, spoke to a lot of people, and followed up on every lead possible." Now, reading between the lines here, my takeaway is that they absolutely spoke to this father, probably confirmed what Rachel was talking about, but most importantly, checked into the father's alibi. Where was he on the night in question? Can he be accounted for? And I hope they went as far as checking phone GPS coordinates and maybe trying to corroborate his whereabouts with someone other than himself. Was there anybody else with him who could say, yeah, he was here, nowhere near Rachel's apartment complex? Now, I'm not saying that he's responsible, but having this happen and not knowing who shot her, everyone's a suspect. And when you have the victim making a call like this, only a few months prior, that's something you definitely want to investigate thoroughly. Now, in the report, it also clarified some details about Rachel's living arrangements. While earlier reporting stated she moved in on June 2nd, the police documents indicate that she actually returned home on June 1st. According to the report, Rachel had several reasons for moving back into her apartment, one of which being ongoing issues with the subletters. Those issues eventually escalated, leading Rachel to evict them for failing to pay their rent. And as I said in the last episode when I covered it, this is something that needs to be explored extensively, not only because of the motive associated with the eviction, but also what were the subletters involved in? Did they have any other enemies? Was there anybody else that they also were not paying? These are questions that absolutely have to be answered. And although I would hate for it to be the case, there is a potential scenario here where this was a shooting, which was the result of mistaken identity. Someone who maybe had an axe to grind with the previous renters could have shot Rachel by mistake. Now, just to be fair and impartial, I will say there's something we're going to talk about in a few minutes that may discredit the potential theory of mistaken identity. Okay, so let's talk about this report some more. As soon as Rachel moved back into her apartment, a different series of problems began to unfold. One of the first problems was discovered by a maintenance worker who noticed that the unit's locks had been changed. Rachel did speak to the leasing agent about this, but her explanation was redacted from the police report, so it's unclear whether Rachel had changed the locks herself or it had been done by the previous tenants. And because of how soon this happened after the whole eviction, you would think it would have been Rachel, but there are some things that Rachel said to her mother, and we're also going to talk about that, that suggest maybe the tenants changed the locks and Rachel hadn't had a chance to change them again. And if that's true, that's really compelling. And it may explain why her explanation was redacted from the report, because if there's something of value in there that may lead back to someone, that would be a reason for law enforcement to redact it, because they don't want people like myself going down that road. For example, if she said, yeah, no, so-and-so who previously rented this place, they had changed the locks, so therefore they still have a key. Well, I would extrapolate that and say, was so-and-so looked into? Were they vetted? Are they a potential suspect? So to avoid that from both myself and the media, they've redacted that information. That's the only real explanation as to why they would. If it was just as simple as, yeah, no, I changed the locks, why not leave it in there? Now, here's another piece of interesting information that I wasn't originally aware of, but I can understand why law enforcement might have kept this close to the vest initially. Around the same time this whole lock situation was going on, a leasing agent at the complex received a noise complaint from Rachel's neighbors. Now, the agent went to investigate and reported hearing multiple people yelling both inside and outside of Rachel's apartment. The agent did call the police, but when officers arrived, no one answered Rachel's door. My question, and I'm sure it's yours, who was that other person in the apartment and why were they yelling at each other? And yes, this could be the fiance. And do couples fight? Of course they do. And is it possible that when police arrived, they didn't want them to be involved, so they chose not to answer the door? Also very possible. But I'm just hoping behind the scenes, law enforcement talked to the fiance, was able to confirm that it was in fact him, and that the argument was something more trivial than something that could be a potential motive. From everything I've seen, nobody publicly is suspecting the fiance, and I feel very confident in saying that he was one of the top people looked at, and I'm sure his alibi was vetted thoroughly. But speaking of the fiance, there was one update in the report that we know he was at least indirectly involved in. On June 2nd, just 2 days before the murder, Rachel told her fiance about a disturbing incident. She said she woke up to the sound of someone opening her bedroom door and looking inside. Now, this unknown person then closed the door. Rachel got out of bed to investigate, but found no one in the apartment. Now, the front door was shut, but she noticed something unusual: a jar of pickles on her kitchen counter that she didn't buy or place there. Rachel told her mother Kim about the intruder, and Kim recalled the conversation during an interview with ABC 15, saying her first reaction was to ask Rachel why she didn't call the police. Kim explained, quote, but she thought it was somebody that was friends with the people that had the apartment prior to her moving in. 2 days later, Rachel was shot in that apartment. Now, this is what I was talking about earlier. You have these previous tenants. We don't know what their activity was. We don't know what they were involved in or who they were involved with. But for Rachel to say, oh, I thought it could be a friend of the previous tenants, well, how would they gain access to her apartment without a key to the door? That's what I was referencing earlier when I said it's possible that the locks hadn't been changed yet, so Rachel assumed that whoever this was a close friend who had a key. It's also possible that Rachel accidentally left the door unlocked, but I would like to think that if that were the case, she would have said that, and she would have been more open to the possibility that it might not be an associate of the previous tenants. The fact that she thought it was that makes me believe that there was a small group of people who would have been able to gain access without destroying the door, and that person would have had to have access and a key to the lock. That's just my version of how I would extrapolate this out and say, okay, reading between the lines here, if Rachel came to this conclusion, it was because the door wasn't accessible to everyone. And when you factor in the pickles, I think that's a reasonable conclusion to come to. The person enters the apartment thinking that the previous tenants still live there. They bring their own jar of pickles. Then they quickly realize, oh, you know what? there's someone else in that bed. I got to get out of here. So they quietly shut the door, forget the pickles, and just take off as fast as they can. I see where she's coming from. But on the other hand, now knowing what we know, could this have been a stalker? Could this have been someone who had been watching Rachel for a while? Maybe they live in the apartment complex and was slowly getting more brazen. And maybe they left that pickle jar behind because they wanted to mess with her. They wanted to create some paranoia. Doesn't seem like that's what happened, but maybe they were trying to taunt her. Maybe they were trying to torture her. Maybe there was something going on in their brains where they felt some type of gratification to leave something behind that belonged to them. And this is a really disturbing picture to paint, but it's something we at least have to talk about. But I will say, as I sit here right now, it honestly doesn't seem like the most plausible. When we think about someone stalking their victims, usually, not all the time, usually there's a sexual element to it. And before the victims are killed, there is some type of assault. And that doesn't appear to be the case from everything that's been released so far. It looks like it was pretty quick. She was shot. She really didn't have much warning. And the shooter got out of there as fast as possible. No sexual element as far as we know. That to me screams targeted attack. This was a vendetta. This was retaliation. And if we can't connect that to Rachel's ongoing chain of events in her life, and we can't find any enemies that would want to hurt Rachel, then that's why I go back to the previous tenants. And without me knowing who they are, I'm not saying they're directly involved, but their association with whoever they may have been, you know, interacting with, conducting business with, that may be the reason that Rachel's dead. We got a lot more to cover, but before we do, let's take our first break.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, we're back. So during the investigation into Rachel's murder, police did look into reviewing security cameras at the apartment complex, but they were told that there were, quote, no operational cameras anywhere in the complex. This directly contradicts earlier media reports, which stated that cameras were installed on the property, but only in the building's common areas, not in the hallways. Now in 2024, I don't even know how that's a thing. How are these companies not required to have security cameras in their buildings? Larcenies, vandalisms, robberies, you name it. All these facilities, all these apartment complexes, it should be a law. They should all be required to have cameras in not only the common areas, but all the hallways, all the elevators, anywhere where you're not entitled to some type of privacy. If expectation of privacy is not required, there should be a camera. Now, the newly released police reports also revealed that detectives interviewed dozens of people during the investigation. This included a man incarcerated in Yuma and another person in custody with the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. However, the extensive redactions in the report make it unclear why these people were questioned. Obviously, I would love to have that information. I can only assume that they may have had some leads they were following up on. And based on where we are right now, they didn't lead anywhere or they didn't have enough to at least take it the next step. Now, when the assistant police chief was asked about all these redactions, he explained, quote, the redactions are there because we feel that if that information was released, it could jeopardize the case. Like I said before, people know specifically what happened. And my reaction to this? Of course there is. We know there are people out there that know what happened to Rachel, at least one, probably more. As far as the redactions, I get it. It sucks for me covering the case now and for everybody following up on it and people who have an investment and want to know what happened to Rachel. But it appears that law enforcement has decided any names or information that could link to a person of interest or suspect has been removed from the case, which explains what I was saying earlier about Rachel's response to the locks. That's why I believe that it wasn't her who changed them, because if it was, I think it would have said that. Clearly, she's not a suspect. But because it was probably done by someone else, and we could take it upon ourselves to look into that and kind of, you know, theorize on what that means, they've decided to protect all those names. Maybe not just to protect them, but they don't want people going out there and working as private detectives or vigilantes and taking this case on themselves. And I understand that. You got to do it. And there may also be some guilt knowledge in there. So it all plays into it. It's unfortunate as I sit here trying to relay the story to you, but as a detective, I get it. Now, as far as what we do know, the police reports detail how, as the investigation progressed, search warrants were filed for social media accounts and cell phones. Investigators also sent numerous items off for testing, but no matches were found. The specifics of what was submitted for testing was, of course, also redacted. As you can imagine and probably understand, all these redactions have been very difficult for Rachel's parents. Her mother Kim shared, quote, "It's so hard as a grieving family to wait so long with no answers. It's really hard to go on in everyday life." At the end of October, Silent Witness announced a $15,000 reward for information leading to a break in Rachel's case. It was also revealed that Rachel's parents are now working with a private investigator in the hopes of uncovering new leads. Unfortunately, that's the most recent update we have in Rachel's case, so the search for her killer continues. And just to wrap up that update, I want to send my thoughts again out to Rachel's family. I've heard that they had a positive response to the original episode. It was shared in Rachel's Facebook group. So I'm glad that we were able to cover it properly the first time. And just know we're continuing to follow the case and we're hoping for an update as soon as possible for you, for your family, and most importantly for Rachel. And although this is an update episode, there may be some of you who are hearing or seeing this case for the first time. So just a quick recap. At around 2 a.m. on June 4th, 2022, a gunman entered Rachel Hansen's apartment located at 1900 South Coronado Road in Gilbert, Arizona, and shot her once while she was sleeping. Anyone with information on Rachel's murder should leave an anonymous tip by calling Silent Witness at 480-WITNESS. That's WITNESS. Okay, moving on to the next update, Madalena Kojikari. To recap the original episode, on November 21st, 2022, 11-year-old Madalena attended Bailey Middle School in Cornelius, North Carolina. She got off the bus after school and headed home, but after that, she was never seen again. Over the following week, school officials made numerous attempts to contact Madalena's parents to check on her whereabouts, but they received no response. Eventually, a meeting was scheduled for December 15th with Madalena's mother, Diana, who was instructed to bring Madalena with her. When Diana arrived at the meeting, Madalena wasn't with her, and that's when Diana admitted that Madalena was missing. She claimed that she had last seen her daughter on the evening of November 23rd following an argument with her husband, Chris Palmiter. Diana said when she checked Madalena's room the next morning, she was gone, but instead of contacting the police or even her husband, who had traveled to Michigan after their argument, she waited until his return on November 26th before addressing the issue, and even then, they still did not call the police to report Madalena missing. After hearing from Diana and her side of the story, Chris was brought to the school to speak with detectives as well, but he claimed he didn't even know Madalena was missing. Because Diana and Chris didn't report Madalena missing, both were charged with failure to report the disappearance of a child. A full-scale investigation into Madalena's whereabouts began, and authorities uncovered significant inconsistencies in the parents' statements, as well as suspicious behavior. But despite extensive searches, interviews, and numerous tips, Madalena's whereabouts remain unknown. In May of 2024, just before I released Madalena's episode, Diana pleaded guilty to failure to report Madalena missing. She was sentenced to time served and was released. Chris, however, was set to go to trial shortly after the episode aired. Now, let's talk about what came out during Chris's trial. While much of the testimony focused on whether or not Chris knew Madalena was missing rather than the investigation into her disappearance, there were some new details revealed. For example, during the investigation, police discovered that Diana had sent thousands of dollars to her home country of Moldova in December of 2022. The money was sent to a church or a priest, though the purpose for that money remains unclear as far as the public knows. Through Chris's trial, we also learned more about his and Diana's relationship. Chris testified that he met Diana through an online dating site called Global Ladies in 2008. 2 years later, he traveled to Moldova where he met her in person. However, after his visit, Diana stopped communicating with him when she became pregnant with Madalena, who had been fathered by another man. Diana reconnected with Chris after Madalena's birth, and the two resumed their relationship. It would take years of navigating visa issues before Diana and Madalena could join Chris in the United States, finally arriving in December of 2015. Chris testified that after Diana arrived in the United States, they had 90 days to get married or she would have to return to her home country. The two married in early 2016, and according to Chris, the relationship was never physically intimate. Chris claimed that Diana was primarily responsible for raising Madalena. However, Madalena did call Chris dad, and he referred to her as his daughter. During his testimony, Chris went on to describe Diana as a deeply religious and often suspicious person. He said that when people asked about what Diana did for a living, she would tell them she, quote, saves souls. Chris said that by 2022, Diana was becoming increasingly spiritual and less attentive to Madalena. According to Chris, Diana often spoke about, quote, fighting demons and performed spiritual rituals. He described instances where she would chant loudly at night so loud that she would wake them up, and on one occasion he said that Diana had him and Madalena take turns sitting in a chair while she placed a knife underneath them so she could, quote, clear the demons. Chris also testified that as Diana's behavior became more focused on spirituality, she started burning unusual items, including cat litter boxes, in the fire pit outside. Now, if you remember from the first episode, on November 30th, just weeks before everyone found out that Madalena was missing, police responded to a call at the Kojikari home. Neighbors reported seeing Diana burning furniture in the backyard, and when officers arrived, they found Diana burning items, but no further details about what she was burning was ever disclosed. So this could be what they were referring to, these cat litter boxes and other unusual items. That may have been what she was out in the backyard burning at that time. Chris testified that Diana became increasingly paranoid and believed that both Vladimir Putin and Michael Jackson, yes, the deceased musician, were after her and Madalena. According to his testimony, quote, she believed Russian entities were following her to get to her and Madalena. She was asking me how we could hide her and Madalena from these people. Chris could be lying just to try and separate himself from whatever happened to Madalena, but he wasn't the only person saying this. Chris's brother Paul also testified during the trial. He recounted that Chris came to visit him in Michigan on November 23rd, and he asked Paul if Madalena could stay with him. Chris said that Diana was worried someone from her past was looking for her. Paul ultimately declined, saying he felt uncomfortable with the idea and didn't want anyone showing up at his house. Paul also described another unusual incident where Diana showed up at his house in Michigan, unannounced, wearing a disguise. She again wanted to see if Paul and his wife would be willing to let Madalena come and live with them, and again, they were reluctant to do so. We got more to cover. We're going to get into it right after this break.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who pieced together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, we're back, and let's dive more into Chris's testimony about what happened when he returned home to Cornelius from Michigan. Because again, according to him, he had no idea that Madalena was missing at this point. So he gets home, and according to him, Diana actively deceived him, claiming that Madalena was sick and resting in her bedroom. And Diana also instructed him not to bring her food or not to check on her. Now, Chris's claim that he didn't know Madalena was missing is very difficult to believe for several reasons. First off, his bedroom shared a wall with Madalena's. So are we supposed to believe he didn't find it strange at all that he never heard a noise coming from her room for weeks? Additionally, during the time that Chris said he didn't realize Madalena was gone, the school was actively trying to contact him directly. Now, at trial, it was revealed that Chris, not Diana, was listed as Madalena's emergency contact at school. And when the school tried to find out why Madalena hadn't been attending class, they repeatedly reached out to Chris, and over a two-week period, they left multiple voicemails, but Chris never responded. What I found interesting is that there was another person listed as an emergency contact for Madalena, and we don't know who that person was, but we do know it wasn't Diana. Now, while the identity of this other person is unclear, we do know that they answered their phone and told the school that Madalena was sick and that's why she wasn't attending class. So that's interesting. Would love to know who they are, because if it's not Diana, that means that someone else was in on this ruse. If Chris wasn't in on it, that means there's another co-conspirator. There's someone else involved that hasn't been brought into the fold, at least publicly, and may be connected to Madalena's disappearance, because you have to imagine that unless they were just getting their information through Diana, they would have also known that Madalena wasn't sick. Now, as we discussed previously, on December 15th, Diana was instructed to come to the school and bring Madalena with her. However, when Diana arrived, Madalena wasn't with her. Diana claimed that she hadn't seen her daughter since November 23rd, following an argument with her husband, Chris, after which time he left for Michigan. Chris was also called to the school for questioning, and at his trial, body cam footage of his conversation with detectives was played for the jury. According to WSOC-TV, Chris offered four ideas about where Madalena might be. He suggested she could be at a friend's house, but he couldn't provide a name. Then he mentioned hearing in the news that kids get kidnapped and speculated that could have happened to her. He also thought she might be at school. And finally, he claimed that Madalena had been in her room the whole time. Unsurprisingly, police found both Chris and Diana's story suspicious and inconsistent. Detectives didn't believe that they were being told the truth, so Chris and Diana were arrested and charged with failure to report Madalena missing. Now, when Chris testified at trial, he was asked again what he thought happened to Madalena. His responses were different than what he said on December 15th. This time he said, quote, "I think Diana took her somewhere with maybe her Moldovan family. I don't know, but I believe that Diana has her tucked away somewhere where she's not going to be found." Now, it's important to note that Diana did not testify during Chris's trial. Her attorney had warned the court prior to the trial that if she was put on the stand, she would just plead the fifth, so it sounds like they decided not to waste their time bringing her in. In the end, the jury found Chris guilty of failing to report Madalena missing, but under the state's sentencing guidelines, prison was not an option. So instead, the judge sentenced Chris to 30 months of supervised probation. Man, you really got him there. After the trial, the Cornelius Police Department issued a statement saying, quote, "We are glad to put this behind us and renew our focus on the efforts of finding Madalena." Well, I hope the focus never came off of that, but I understand what they're saying here. They were fighting two different things. They had this charge of failing to report Madalena missing and also obviously find her. And I think the hope with this trial was to tighten the screws on Chris and maybe have him divulge some information that could assist in the missing persons case of Madalena. And based on what I've read and based on what I've relayed to you guys today, there may have been some things that came out of that trial that may help them ultimately get to their goal, which is to just make sure Madalena is okay and she's with the right people. Because clearly, if we take anything from what we've covered so far, Diana and Chris are not those people. Now, there wasn't another major update until late June when the police announced that Diana was officially considered a suspect in Madalena's disappearance. Along with this announcement, they released a new flyer featuring Madalena's photo as well as Diana's and urged the public to come forward with any information. Now, my takeaway from this, the fact that they're releasing Madalena's photo and Diana's photo and not Chris's, it tells me that they believe there's some validity to the theory that Diana took Madalena somewhere. Where that is, we don't know, but I think they're banking on someone coming forward who saw Madalena and Diana traveling together. I don't know how they would have traveled, but some way. And if they had that information, they can at least use that as a checkpoint to figure out where the final destination might have been. Moldova with Diana's family would be a good option. But I would imagine even without having that connecting dot to get to Moldova, that's something they would have already looked into and potentially vetted, maybe getting the FBI involved. But if they have done that, they definitely will not release that information publicly. In mid-July, Diana posted on social media that she was flying back to Romania, a neighboring country of Moldova. As we've discussed in the original episode, Moldova does not have an extradition treaty with the U.S., meaning Diana would not be required to return if additional charges were filed against her. And as you can imagine, this development upset a lot of people, but the police explained that there was nothing they could do. Diana was a free woman with no active arrest warrants, so she was allowed to leave the country, and they couldn't stop her. On November 21st, 2024, it had been 2 years since Madalena was last verifiably seen, and at that time, the Cornelius police chief provided an update on the case. He stated that prior to Diana leaving the country, she continued to say that she didn't know where Madalena was. The chief also confirmed that there were no records indicating Madalena had left or was taken out of the country. The chief assured the community that the Cornelius Police Department remained committed to finding Madalena, saying, quote, "This is not a cold case. It'll never be a cold case. Madalena is too important to this department, to this community." Unfortunately, that is the last update we have in Madalena's case. Her whereabouts and, most importantly, her current condition remain unknown. I am optimistic, based on what we uncovered in the first episode and now what we have with these updates, that it is a strong possibility Madalena is out there and as far as she knows, living a normal life. She may be with friends and family over in Moldova or another country. How she got there, we don't know, but we are going to continue to follow this case. And as law enforcement has asked, we are also asking our listeners and viewers, if you have any information, take a look at the flyer, please report it to the authorities immediately. So for everybody out there, just to recap, the last official sighting of Madalena Kojakari was on November 21st, 2022, when she was seen getting off the school bus near her house located at 18413 Victoria Bay Drive in Cornelius, North Carolina. If you have any information concerning the whereabouts of Madalena Kojakari, please contact the Cornelius Police Department at 704-892-7773. There is a $25,000 reward available. Like I said, wrapping up this episode, I'm not going to send my thoughts to Diana and Chris. I don't really think they deserve them, but I am hoping that we find out what happened to Madalena. Like I said in the closing, I am very cautiously optimistic that she's out there somewhere and she's probably okay. But until we have that information and definitively know that's the case, I stand by what the chief of police said. This is not a cold case. It'll never be a cold case for us. And regardless of how long it takes, we will find Madalena and make sure that she's okay. So that's going to do it for the update episode. I hope that in 2025, we have more updates from not only the cases we've already covered, but the ones we're going to cover moving forward. And speaking of moving forward, I couldn't do this without the team. Putting out all these episodes this year was not easy, and it's a struggle. It's a grind to make sure that we get them out on time at the level that I expect, right? I don't want to just put something out there that's garbage. It has to be up to the standard that I set for myself, and I think we accomplished that. So thank you to the team, Ashley for doing the thumbnails, for uploading on all the platforms, Haley doing the research and script writing, and then Shannon doing the editing. I couldn't do it without you guys, so thank you so much. And we're going to keep it going in 2025. We're not slowing down. If anything, we're going to do more. We're going to expand. Like I said, I have some new things coming that are going to go hand in hand with what we're doing right here. Spoiler alert, may involve some interviews, some actual in-studio interviews. You know, just saying, if you made it to the end of the episode, now you know. But there's some other things as well that I'm going to keep close to the chest for now. I also want to continue donating to the causes that are needed. We did Season of Justice, and we also did Higher Hope this year. And that brings me to the final thing I want to talk about, Criminal Coffee. Most of you, I'm assuming you're watching me on Crime Weekly. If you're not, I am the co-owner of a coffee company called Criminal Coffee, and it's a true crime-themed coffee, and we donate a portion of the proceeds to solving cold cases. We've already solved one 60-year-old case called Preble Penny. We're now working on another case out of Houston. We're referring to the victim as Caroline. We just announced this on Crime Weekly a week ago, and I can tell you there's already updates. I can't say what they are, but we're moving fast on this one. I've been talking to the team. Genealogists are already working on it, and we've already got some major, major developments. So I can't wait to share that with you. But if you want to check out Criminal Coffee, you can go to criminalcoffeeco.com. And right now would be the time to do it, because as you're listening or watching this episode, we have just released our first flavored coffee. It's peppermint bark. It's absolutely delicious. So if you're someone who doesn't like just regular coffee and you need some flavor and you want it for the holiday season, head on over to the website, check it out. And I'm packing some of the orders. So if you do it right away, who knows, I may be packing yours. Again, everybody, thank you so much for the love, the support, and the drive to continue doing what I'm doing. After a year, I could have just said, hey, we're folding it up. We're not doing it anymore, but there's no shot. I'm inspired by your words, and it makes me want to do even more. So we're going to keep growing. You're going to grow with me. I hope everyone has a safe and happy holiday, and I'll see you in the new year.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.